Hi, hello, welcome. 欢迎大家 to another installment of Hot and Sour Soup for the Soul and to the Year of the Ox. Happy Lunar New Year, y'all. You know, I'm not someone to buy into things like horoscopes. It just seems a little too prescriptive to me, but I digress. With the Chinese zodiacs, though, I have found that there are some parallels to the year that we just lived through and the year that is upon us. The past year, if you didn't know, was the year of the rat, and I would say that rats are known for their scrappiness, their resourcefulness, and for most of us in the past 365 days, if we were given a metaphorical pizza in a subway station that we may have turned our nose up to before, the past year has changed that. We would probably take that pizza, see what we can do with it, what we can make with it, and how many people we can feed with it. We have become more resourceful and more resilient. For that, I am grateful for the Year of the Rat. There have also been a lot of racial conversations that have spawned in the past year that we are continuing to have, that it is necessary to continue having. And it makes sense that we are in the Year of the Ox. The ox is known for its strength, patience, and persistence. Three nouns that will likely serve us well as we move forward in questioning convention and reshaping expectation around what life can and would be better off looking like. So, with all that being said, let's get to this new episode. I'm going to start with three phrases. Tiger mom upbringing, MIT undergraduate degree, Stanford PhD candidacy. If you grew up with Asian parents, this trinity might sound familiar, and if you didn't, let me get you up to speed. These were the storied markers of that child, niece, or nephew of your parents' friend of a friend. You know, the one you may have never met, but were certainly made aware of their achievements. These were the Asian kids that had successfully walked the high-achieving tightrope, and this was the path to aspire to. So, what does that all have to do with today's episode? Well, today's guest happens to be that high-achieving poster child you heard about in your childhood. Her name is Allison Konecki, and she's a Hapa, half Asian, half Caucasian, and turns out she is exemplary. But far beyond the two-dimensional poster child we thought we knew growing up. She's exceptional, not because of the various institutional associations that dot her resume, though those are impressive too. What's most impressive are the causes Allison has invested her brain power into, specifically equity in machine learning and causal inference in the public health space. Allison is ensuring the software we live with and, if we're honest with ourselves, live within, take into account the full spectrum of colors, creeds, and communities, not just a select subset. In this episode, Allison and I chat about the little-known secrets about the path to a PhD, what she's uncovered in her research on racial disparities in voice assistant software, the Siri, the Alexa that we all know, as well as simple tricks we can all employ to get more out of our days. Stay tuned. Hey, Allison.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Great to have you on the show. Let us kick off with your past. Can you share with us a little bit about your family and your upbringing?
Sure. So I guess I'm the first Hapa on the show, which means I'm half Asian. My mom was from Shanghai, and my dad is from Wisconsin. So he's a German descendant American. And as for my childhood, I lived my entire time pre-college in Northern Virginia, in the suburb of DC. There were so many Asian Americans in our community, like to the point where there were multiple competing Chinese school organizations. I don't know if listeners are familiar with that. And so I always felt more Asian than white growing up, where my main extracurriculars were like violin and piano and Chinese dance. So like the Asian Trinity. And the high school that I went to was like half Asian, 50% Asian at the time. So that was kind of the crux of my upbringing. And then meanwhile, my white family was super supportive of me having just an immersive Chinese upbringing so I could stay in touch with my roots. So I really appreciate that as well.
Yeah. And I heard from a little birdie that you grew up with a bit of a tiger mom.
That's right. The like funny Chinese school thing is she actually pulled me out of all of these competing Chinese schools because she thought that they were too tame and too easy. So instead I stayed at home and memorized like the Book of Tao with my mom. So yeah, that was the start of my education.
You know, looking back, I guess we can take a quick trip through the time machine to the present, but looking back on that period of time, what reflections do you have? Are you glad to have grown up in that kind of an intense family environment? Or is it something that you want to move away from when you raise your children? What are your thoughts?
I mean, much like everything, it's kind of, you see pros and cons. And so on the plus side, I think it was definitely great in terms of the focus on education and helping breed resilience and grit. On the flip side, I do also think that there are probably other routes to get to where I am today without having gone through the tiger mom upbringing. But all in all, I can't change anything. I'm pretty happy with where I am now. So not convinced that I will use the same upbringing in the future with any children I come in contact with, but I am grateful for what I have.
Yeah. Well, let's chat a little too about your Hapa identity and your relationship with being of mixed race. Is this something that you were always aware of and something that played a role in the way that you went about interactions with either the Asian community or the white community? Or is it something that just fell to the wayside and, you know, I am Allison and I am a Hapa, but that's kind of an afterthought?
Yeah, so honestly, as I mentioned, my community was very heavily Asian dominated, especially like the circles that my parents were friends with were pretty much all Chinese Americans. And I never really thought twice about it. But during the summers, I would go to China with my mom and spend like the entire summer there. And that was actually where I became much more acutely aware of my race. And so while I do have a lot of good memories from China, it was also kind of the first time where suddenly I was very much othered. And it was like the first thing that people noticed about me was like, wow, she's white. Or like, wow, she's white, and therefore she is like tall. And so it was just a bunch of these very foreign concepts to me in terms of being seen for my race as opposed to just like whatever I was doing. So then after those experiences in China, as I grew older, I became kind of more aware of my white passing privilege in the US because in China, my Hapa identity would mean that people tended to treat me politely. In the US, it meant that I also didn't need to prove myself as a model minority. And so I just kind of became more aware of that privilege as time went on.
Mm-hmm. And we can speak a little bit more about that in terms of the research that you're doing in your PhD. But before we get to that point, let's talk about the journey between you making that first homecoming back to China and you working at Stanford right now in your PhD. So take us through your journey into college and also more importantly, your first few gigs out of college before you decided to pursue your graduate degree.
Sure. So people always kind of assume that when you're doing a PhD, you've always been like the kid who got like straight A's in school and always loved taking classes. And I've found that to very much not be the case now that I'm here. And I can speak to myself as definitely not ever really seriously considering like, oh, I'm gonna ace all my classes and do a PhD. I kind of happened to fall into the right places at the right times. And so like in high school, I was decent at math, but I was kind of passive and my mom pushed me to like, oh, you should just like major in math in college. And I was like, well, I kind of suck at science and I'm not great at humanities, so I guess I'll major in math. And so that's what I ended up doing. But during college, I ended up taking some econ classes as well. And that was when everything kind of started to click for me and that I was interested in like the real life applications of this theory stuff that I've learned through taking all my math classes. And that class led to me interning at an econ consulting firm, which is where I ended up working after college. So that was NERA, and I worked primarily on the antitrust and competition group cases. And so that's a lot of mergers and acquisitions.
And the intense work environments have been a bit of a prevailing theme in your life, growing up with the Tiger Mom, then going to, you didn't name it, but I will, MIT for your undergrad, you know, full of brainiacs, and then working at NERA, which was also a very demanding job where you pulled long hours and probably had very little sleep. So how were you able to keep that tenacity through this like everlasting period of really demanding work classroom culture?
Yeah, so definitely true about lots of late nights. Honestly, I do think I had a leg up and was very privileged because I was very used to these high stress academic environments by nature of always being in, you know, these competitive schools and doing competition math and the Tiger Mom thing and all that. And so that made the transition to continuing to do these long nights, you know, a bit easier. But the other main thing is just always being taught the value of hard work from an early age, especially by my dad, who wasn't as very into like the canonical Protestant work ethic. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that I'm very big into working on teams. So I'm just much more motivated to do things if I'm on a team. And at NERA, that was very much the case.
Can you speak more about that, working on a team and aligning incentives when you are leading a team? Because you led, what, six analysts when you're at NERA? So how did you get everyone rallied up and together to present a united front as you guys were working your 80-hour work weeks?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of it is empathy, right? Because everyone's plowing through it together. And so you do want to present your true self and recognize that, like, you know, you're all in it together. But yeah, like I said, I do end up much more motivated if I'm on a team. And I think reflecting that back, hopefully I was an effective manager by leveraging that to encourage people to work together. Because, you know, if everyone does their part, then maybe we can all get the weekend off and that sort of thing. And another thing to be cognizant of is mental health and just making sure that everyone you work with has the space to decompress. Because at some point, you're just not going to be effective at your job if you're constantly working.
Mm-hmm. For you personally, how do you make that space to decompress?
Oh man, I wish I had a better answer for this because during quarantine, I have not been decompressing. In normal times, I would say music. So like I mentioned, I play violin and piano, but given my space constraints during quarantine, I've been trying to be more respectful of neighbors and not be too loud.
So have you found a stopgap if violin and piano aren't something readily available right now?
I've been doing Zoom calls with friends. So that's my main thing now.
Yeah, socializing never hurts. An additional question, because you did grow up in such an academic space and you have proven to be in the top, let's say 99th percentile academically, what tips do you have for people who are trying to learn new information and synthesize that new information? Do you have any strategies in which you take on a new topic of study and become an expert in it?
That's a really good question. I guess if you're in an academic environment, the kind of obvious path is, you know, try to take classes that will help you learn about that specific thing. You know, don't be scared to take the class if you don't have friends taking the class. And then if you're not in an academic environment, you know, Coursera and other MOOCs exist. It's also very easy these days to fall down kind of these YouTube rabbit holes. 3Blue1Brown or brilliant.org is another great resource. These are all great ways to learn if you're interested in kind of specific niche things in the math side of things.
I haven't heard of some of these sites like brilliant.org, so we'll definitely leave those links in the show notes for people who are interested. And I asked that question because I know Elon Musk, for instance, has gone on record saying he likes basically like neural trees where he'll start very broad and then dive really deep into different specialties to fully understand a theme that he's interested in. So if he's into AI, then he'll like start studying neural nets really specifically. And then he might start doing like emotional processing and go from there. And that's how he becomes, you know, a mastermind in this like larger theme. So curious if you employ any of those approaches where you start big and then go into very specific micro trails, if you will, before like looping back around into the big one, or if you are more of a dive 100 miles deep before expanding 100 miles wide. Do you have any opinions regarding what strategy to take there?
Yeah, definitely. So it's funny, the Elon route, I guess, as you can call it, is often how a PhD is structured, or at least it was the case in my department. It varies from school to school and from department to department. But in my case, there are, you know, some number of broad based classes that you take in order for you to gain a better understanding of the lay of the land. So the idea is that everyone in my program is going to specialize in a different thing, but you still want everyone to have the same foundational knowledge, the same ability to read basic notation, and understanding of these basic concepts, so that even if you didn't study the specific thing that your friends in your cohorts end up studying, you can still kind of understand the basic gist of it. In my program, at least, I basically spent the first 2 years taking classes. And then after that, during the PhD, you basically end up in a space where a lot of what you're doing is totally new, and there aren't necessarily classes to teach you exactly how to do these things. You have to figure them out for yourself by reading papers, or like following the relevant people on Twitter and having conversations with strangers to kind of find your way through. And so in that sense, it is kind of, you take the broad knowledge that you have and then you kind of go down these rabbit holes. And oftentimes people think, oh, you do a PhD, so you like study the same thing for 5 years and you like continue down this one hole that you've started drilling. But in reality, it's like you start drilling down this hole and you realize you like don't actually care about it. So then you start drilling down another hole and then you realize like someone already did this 20 years ago. So then you stop and you like pivot and your tunnel takes a giant turn and suddenly you're in like a totally different area. And then you realize like, oh, in order to actually understand what's going on in this area, I have to take more classes because I don't have kind of a basic understanding anymore. I think the average PhD is actually quite circuitous.
So you spoke a lot about your PhD, but I'd like to bridge that gap between Nira and you deciding to pursue a PhD. So what was going on in your mind when you decided, okay, I don't want to be making high six figures anymore. Instead, I want to go study and be a academic.
Yeah, so I actually thought that my work at Nira was super interesting and super intellectually challenging. But at the end of the day, you think about it and you're like, oh, I'm kind of being a data monkey and helping these big companies get bigger by merging. And so it's like, okay, that isn't like the most compelling reason for me to be doing this thing. So at that point, I started thinking about potentially doing a master's or a PhD. What ended up happening is I asked my boss to write me a rec to apply for master's programs. And he was like, no, you should apply for a PhD program because PhDs are free and masters are not. And he was like, if you want to drop out and you don't want to do research, that's fine. You can drop out after 2 years and it's a free master's. And that was the best advice I could have gotten. And I ended up applying for a PhD then.
Two questions about the PhD. So for anyone who's pursuing a PhD, they get a master's along the way?
Not necessarily. It depends on the program. Usually you'll have to take additional classes in order to get the master's. But often it's you end up taking the classes anyways just to get a better understanding of the baseline knowledge you should have to do a PhD.
Got it. And then second question is, who funds the PhD education? How do you guys pay it back, if you will? Because it's an investment in the candidate, right?
Yeah, definitely. So that also varies from school to school and person to person. Usually the department will pay for your first 2 years of tuition. And then once you get an academic advisor, it's kind of the professor's job to obtain funding in order to fund their students. There are also ways to be funded through fellowships. So for me personally, I'm on NSF funding, which means that taxpayer dollars fund me, and I'm very thankful for that. So thank you.
Hey, crowdfunding. It's an academic Kickstarter. I'm all about it. So let's talk about your PhD then. Now that we've made that transition from Nira over to pursuing a graduate degree, how did you pick your specialty?
Definitely. I don't think it was necessarily so much picking it as I thought I was interested in something. I tried out for a bit. You know, for a while I was like, oh, I would like to work on public health with a specific professor, but then professor left Stanford. So then I was like, oh, well, maybe I can try public health as it pertains to fairness. And then I ended up working more on algorithmic fairness problems. But then COVID happened. And then I was like, oh, maybe I can do some work on epidemiology as well. Really, it was a circuitous, like, well, I know that I have these tools in econ and CS that I want to use. I'm just not sure how I want to apply them. Very much trial and error, trial by fire, both at the same time, and figuring out what I wanted to do.
Yeah, what specific studies have you been involved in as it relates to public health and fairness and equity?
So I guess I'll talk about racial disparities in automated speech recognition, which is essentially a study where we evaluated five different companies' speech recognition systems. So for example, if you think about your Google Home or Siri or Alexa, the APIs that underlie likely the same technologies from those relevant companies, they often are trained with white speakers' speech. And so when your training data are not diverse, you end up with models that end up basically only working really well and being accurate for white speakers and not, for example, African-American vernacular English speakers. And so our study quantified the disparities we found there between standard English and app speakers. And we found that these speech recognition systems were roughly generating twice as many errors for app speakers.
Mm-hmm. What's the path forward? How do we solve for this gap in voice recognition?
Yeah, so, my response is two-pronged. Firstly, on the technical side, focusing on gathering more diverse training data and making that part of the pipeline. So making sure that when you do collect data to use in these models, make sure that you have representation from app speakers, from speakers with Southern accents, Scottish accents, non-native English speakers. Those all should be represented in order to form a model that can perform better with regards to diversity. And the second thing that I would mention is this isn't obviously just a technical problem, this is also very much a people problem, because things like the speech diversity should be something that people think about, and yet somehow no one at these companies thought about them until we published this paper. You really do need to emphasize that there should be people in the pipelines thinking about these problems. So whether these are the software engineers working on these teams, or the PMs, or the people doing the data collection, or the people marketing these products, you should have people at every step of the way who are thinking about this issue of diversity first and foremost, and not just as an afterthought and kind of jamming in these last minute fixes. So those are kind of my main calls to action.
Yeah. I mean, this is a study that really captures the zeitgeist. So I'm curious how you are able to get involved with these studies. I imagine that certain professors in certain areas of study are very popular. And so people are clamoring, PhD candidates possibly are clamoring to be a part and involved in that field study. So what is the process like when you are in it as a PhD candidate? How are you able to align yourself with certain professors in certain areas of study and be a part of these projects?
Definitely. So again, it varies a lot from field to field. So for me, I've often found that the best way to start working with a professor is just form a dialogue. So if you just approach them and ask for a project, sometimes professors will be like, sure, I have 10,000 project ideas and no one to work on them, and they'll just give you a project. But I've found it more effective to approach them and be like, hey, here are some problems that I'm thinking of. What do you think of them? And like most of the time, they'll be terrible ideas and you don't realize until after they've explained why that they're terrible ideas. But you know, you make a good faith effort to kind of show that you've done your background research and your homework in the area and you have some thoughts about them. They'll tell you why your thoughts are probably bad, but that's what really gets the dialogue started, and then you can start having some back and forth about a project idea, and that kind of more organically generates the project.
Yeah, so a lot of this is relationship-based too. It's not something that you can just get sitting in a library doing hours and hours of research. There needs to be that human element, even when you are pursuing something as academic as, you know, conventionally we would believe a PhD is.
Also a lot of politics to counterweight the good with the bad. There's also a lot of politics.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people are not aware of in the world of academia, the politics involved. Can you speak a little bit more about that and how politics are played in higher education?
I mean, like one of the easy examples, you know, going off of my paper, for example, is, you know, this leads to a lot of ivory tower discussion of like, okay, but what about data privacy? Or like, you know, you shouldn't actually be able to study this sort of stuff because you shouldn't be able to collect people's data. And this is all like a very valid concern and leads to constructive arguments, but there are also ways that they can devolve into non-productive like Twitter arguments. And I just feel like I've seen a lot of academics being dragged on academic Twitter lately. So that's where that comes from. Some of them rightfully so, some of them not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, speaking of things that don't really cross the road of conventional wisdom when it comes to PhD candidacy, what are some things that you were not expecting when you entered into the program and have now since realized being a part of the program?
Good question. Honestly, I think I went in being like super terrified that I would fail all my classes and that the entire thing, like I went in potentially considering mastering out. And I was like, oh, this whole thing is scary. But it turns out, like, if you surround yourself with really great people, as I have with my cohort at Stanford, it's not so terrible and tough to get through the classes. It's still very much doable. And even if you don't feel like you did well in your classes, that doesn't necessarily mean that your entire PhD is doomed. You know, it's okay to not be an expert in everything. You just need to figure out how to become an expert in the thing that you claim you're going to be an expert in. I think the disconnect between classes and research kind of surprised me.
Yeah, and you're coming up on your last year of your PhD program. You graduate in 2021, June. That's still the plan, yeah?
Hopefully. I mean, it's always like a little taboo to ask PhD students when they're going to graduate, because it's always like, well, I'm hoping for this date, but I'm not actually sure because I don't know if I'll get a job and I don't know if I'll pass my defense and like all this other stuff. But in theory, we're hoping for this year or next year. For me, at kind of like the math, CS, econ intersection, anywhere between 5 and 6 is like totally reasonable. There are plenty of, like, there were 7th and 8th year PhD students in my department. I don't think anyone cares or judges if you take more time in your PhD program. It just means that you're becoming more of an expert in that field than other people are. And so also taking a long time is not a shame.
Yeah. And it helps when the education is subsidized. I mean, what's another year when it's costing nothing directly out of the pocketbook? I mean, we can talk about opportunity costs, but right, nothing direct from the pocketbook. When I studied abroad in the Netherlands, there were a lot of students who came over from Finland, and well, most of Western Europe, you get your education subsidized, if not entirely free. And a lot of the Finnish students would get like 3 master's degrees because they're like, why not? You know, this is the government's paying for this. So I don't have a job prospect that is super attractive right now. So let me just tack on another 2-3 years to get another master's.
Definitely. So I will say, so with the like professors funding you and stuff, that actually comes from time, and time is money. So basically you either RA for them or you TA for them, and TAing classes is like a ton of time sunk. So that is how you pay your dues in a lot of aspects. And for the government funded ones, those fellowships are usually time capped. So you actually cannot take additional years if you are not given that money. But
got it.
I love that the Europeans especially have a great system in place with regard to higher education. And I often wish that the US were more like it.
Yeah, they do. And some programs are you get your undergrad in 3 years and your master's in 4. So in the time that it takes for us to get a BA or BS, they already have an MA. A little jealous of that. So question for you regarding longer term prospects coming out of your PhD program, because you have interned at a lot of tech companies in between starting your PhD candidacy and today, including Facebook, Google. So what's the plan once you leave Stanford?
Yeah, so I wish I had a better answer for this. I'm still interested both in academia and in industry. So I think it'd be great if I could work on a career path that lets me kind of get a bit of both. So whether that's a research position in industry, or if that's a more academic position with some consulting roles in industry, I think I'd be happy with either of those. The main thing that I'll be focused on for the next phase of my career is most likely going to be an emphasis on fairness. So fairness in tech, in different algorithmic systems. So not just in speech recognition, but also, for example, in ad bidding technology. These are all things that I'm interested in and hoping to do more of in the future.
Yeah. And then all this research that you've done around fairness, what is one thing that we would all be better off knowing and practicing as it relates to building a more equitable community?
Definitely. So I guess this is where I'll like get on my soapbox. I think it's super important, especially for the Asian American community, to kind of deal with the difficult conversations with our parents that I think we often tend to avoid, especially as it regards to race stuff. So for me personally, my mom actually was not happy with my research. She saw my paper come out about, you know, African American vernacular English, and the question was like, why would you study this? Why aren't you doing like AI robots? You know, like, what is the point? Who cares if they speak differently? Why can't they just, you know, speak better? And so I think it's very easy for people in our generation, especially those who have this sort of like liberal younger college education and skew, it's important for us to understand that we need to have these conversations, and they have to start at home, because it is impossible to just assume that, you know, maybe if you let them read enough internet articles, they'll somehow come around to the idea of, you know, Black Lives Mattering, for example. Our parents, especially if they are immigrants themselves, don't necessarily have that American education of recent history. And so they may not have lived through recent American history. And so they don't necessarily know off the top of their head, you know, the history of the Chinese Exclusion Act or the killing of Vincent Chin, and how that ties into the model minority myth and the kinship between Asian and Black activists in the 60s. And so all of that is not necessarily top of mind. And I think it's really important for the kids, so our generation, to really bring that to the forefront and have those tough conversations.
Yeah. So when your mom is like, Allison, put your PhD candidacy in computational mathematics and engineering towards something that will bring you the big bucks, instead of criticizing these tech companies that have the big bucks, how do you start that conversation with her, speaking about why this research matters?
I think oftentimes it helps when you have a personal connection. So if you can think of, you know, say a Black friend from school who maybe your parents just kind of assume, you know, are worse because they're Black, you can start by talking about how they're not. Another route that I've taken is recommending like documentaries to my parents. So for my mom in particular, I'm like, hey dad, can you have mom sit down and watch like 13th? And so hopefully by just having more of these race-based educational tools in the background will be helpful long-term. And in the short term, just continuing to have kind of those poking and prodding conversations about like, okay, you think this work is not useful, but why don't you think it's useful?
So as you embark on this journey of having these somewhat uncomfortable but instrumental conversations with people near and dear to you and continuing on with your research at the nexus of public health and fairness, what is one motto or rallying cry that you're taking with you?
Okay, so I do have this one piece of advice that I often give people when they're like, Allison, do you have advice? And it's never expected because it's like the least sexy, most literal workplace advice that I could give, but basically just always number your lists. And so there is like the literal workplace application of like, when you number your lists in emails, it's easy because then when you respond to the email, you can reference like, oh, for your point number two above or whatever. But in real life, I also find it really useful to number your lists because it forces you to figure out what your priorities are. So even when I'm making like my daily to-do list of, okay, like what research stuff do I have to do? Just making sure that everything's ordered forces me to consider what my priorities are for that day. And I do this not just on like a daily time scale, but also monthly, I do try to think about, you know, have I hit my quarterly goals? And kind of forcing myself to do, I guess the equivalent of like, for myself because I'm not in an actual workplace anymore. So yeah, number your lists. It's a good thing to do.
I love that. And I love that you mentioned too these performance reviews that you do with yourself. So how do you go about conducting that? I mean, I think a lot of people now, especially when they have something that they moonlight in or like a side hustle or a full-time hustle, when you're working for yourself and you're like the sole proprietor, you have got to keep yourself accountable. So I'm curious with you, when you are working for yourself and your research, how are you doing those performance reviews?
Yeah, so basically I think rule number one is like, don't tie yourself to the specific goal that you have for the next quarter, because if you do, inevitably you won't exactly reach it and then you'll just be sad. So I think it's okay to have slightly evolving goals as the quarter moves on is I think a good motivator. And without it, I often end up doing nothing and just procrastinating. Setting goals and thinking about what matters to you in different categories. So whether that's personal life, health and fitness, academically, socially, things like that. Figuring out what matters.
I've learned a lot in this conversation with you, Allison. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was great.
I look forward to having more tough but important conversations with the people I hold near and dear about fairness and equality. And you definitely have inspired a wave of people to do the same. So thank you for your work.
Thanks so much, Adrian. Looking forward to hearing about your conversations and how they go.
Thanks.
And that's a wrap. As always, thank you for tuning in to Hot and Sour Soup for the Soul. If you like this episode, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe so you are notified whenever new episodes are out. Also, if you're new here, Hot and Sour Soup for the Soul is a multi-sensory experience, so head on over to thebabebrigade.com and you can find the physical product line that complements this digital series. And with that, I wish you all a year of the ox that runneth over with strength, patience, and persistence. And I'll catch you on the next episode. Goodbye. Zai jian. Toodaloo.